Good morning. So last evening, or late yesterday morning, we opened up the question of hermeneutics as a science and the craft of exegesis, its necessity and what's involved in it. This morning I want to complete that by looking at the actual different types of science that are brought to bear on the Bible. Excuse me. When I did my own study, I did it at a place called the Pontifical Biblical Institute. It's a university in Rome, the whole purpose of which is to focus on the Bible. So there's a whopping big library, and the library has only books concerning the Bible in it. That's one place in Rome. They're all over the world, these kind of institutes and libraries. And Jewish and Christian scholars are working obviously together and helping each other in this whole process. It's quite massive, and thank God for it. In that, there's a document, 1993, which I've talked to about a few times, called the Interpretation of the Bible in the Church. And it, in the introduction, Pope John Paul II has this to say about certain documents that have appeared. In 1893, Pope Leo XIII wrote a letter called the Proventissimus Deus. And as stated by John Paul II in the introduction to this, he says, the purpose of that statement was to protect Catholic interpretation from the attacks of rationalist science. I don't think that needs a lot of explanation, but the attack against the Bible was coming from rational science, like how could the world be made in 7 days? How could there be a flood that would cover the whole earth and you could follow the rest of it? Science sometimes poo-pooing the Bible as obviously a lot of airy-fairy stuff. And this document of Leo XIII was there to argue against that rationalist point of view. 50 years later, clearly an anniversary, Pius XII produced a document, Divino Afflante Spirito, which had quite the different focus. It was to defend Catholic interpretation from attacks from those who oppose the use of science in exegesis. It's a religious document, so you shouldn't bring science in. And here is the Church now having to defend itself against that extreme position. Vatican II came out with that quite lovely, not totally comprehensive, statement on Dei Verbum. And then in 1993, and as you can see, that's 100 years after Leo XIII and 50 years after Pius XII, hence its timing, we read, the Church is not afraid of scientific criticism. She distrusts only preconceived opinions that claim to be based on science, but which in an underhand way cause science to depart from its domain. We can all do that, talk outside our area of expertise. And here's science often thinking it's got a full grasp of the truth and reality, and the processes of science are the only processes that'll ever get us to the truth, which is of course ridiculous, and not good scientists aren't doing that, but science, some scientists were, and here's the Church saying, no, wait a minute, there's more to life than what science can find. There's more to reality than what the reason can comprehend and state in clear, rational terms. So that's what that document is about. So in that document we read, or this is my statement but taken from it, what we're seeking, as with any scientific exploration, is a convergence of probabilities to guide us in our pursuit of truth. The science of biblical hermeneutics is advancing by leaps and bounds in our day. especially by the application of what is called the historico-critical method. And that's absolutely basic to this whole process in all areas of hermeneutics. It's historico-critical method. There's more to it than that, but that's really central. The word critical is used here not in the popular sense of fault-finding, which we might talk about, someone's very critical. It's used in the scientific sense of applying the mind in a systematic way. The word criticism derives from the Greek krino, which means to distinguish, to decide, to judge. So it's a discerning process. It's called historico-critical, this method, because those who carry out the research recognize that God's revelation occurs in specific historical circumstances and is revealed to specific people. The more we can understand the circumstances in which the revelation occurred, the more confident we can be in grasping the content of the revelation. I think I can assume, in the light of where we've been the last couple of days, that you're at home with that. First thing we need to do, the scholars need to do, is establish what is the text. We haven't got the originals, of course. We've got copies. Now, we've also got translations to help us. And when you copy something, it depends on how you're doing it. Different mistakes can easily come in. If you're copying by looking at one text and then writing it again somewhere else, the eye can jump a line, as you know. You can have a word here and a word there, and you read that word, write it, and then jump from this word. So you miss out whatever. There's all those, I won't go into them all, but you can imagine the kind of mistakes that a copyist can make if he's working from a particular copy eyesight. A whole other list of mistakes can be made by copyists if you're actually listening. And out front is the master, and he's reading the text. You're not looking at it. You're reading it, you hear it, and you write it. There's a lot of words in Hebrew, as in English and in any language, that sound very much the same. And you might hear it and write down the wrong one. It might happen to half make sense. So there's that kind of possibility. I'll do a little bit more thoroughly in a moment. But other possibilities are, it costs a fortune to skin a lamb or something and turn it inside out and treat it and then get the special stuff to do the writing. It's a fortune. It's very expensive stuff. So if I'm the master and you're the copyists and you're all making copies of the book of Genesis, and thank you very much for doing it, and I walk around and I get to, you do Barry, I get to Barry and I say, "Now Barry, you've missed a line, or you've missed two, three words there. What are you going to do? Scrap the skin and start again?" You can't afford it, you don't. You write in that little gap, the words that you missed out. So someone will see, "Oh, that's what's happened." That's all very well, but there are ancient scripts that people, the copyists, have put in their own little comments in the text. You know, "You can't believe this," you know, or something, 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 something. Then the next person who comes along with this thinks that's a correction that's been put in by the master. So they take that as it and they put it into the next one that they're making. In other words, enough said, there's a whole host of mistakes can be made in copying. What's the original text? Scholars will do their best to find it from that process. They've also got the help of translations, because quite quickly the Hebrew is translated into Greek. We've got the Greek Septuagint to guide us. It was translated into Old Latin. It was translated into Coptic. It was translated into Sahidic. It was translated into whatever languages were around. So that'll help us. So if we can get all these different translations, and there are people doing this, thanks be to God, and we get them, and we see that all of these translations point to an original that's different from the one we've got. So this one is obviously the standard one we've got. Obviously, there's a mistake coming in here somewhere along the line. So we can correct it in the light of all these translations. So there's a big task going on, constantly going on, establishing the text. The task is basically complete now, but there are still tiny refinements that are coming in. Now, prior to the discovery of the Qumran scrolls in 1947, and I'll have to take it you're aware of those, these scrolls that were found in Qumran near the Dead Sea, the oldest manuscript of the complete Hebrew Bible was the Leningrad Codex from 1008 AD. That was the oldest one that was extant. The Aleppo Codex is slightly older, 930 AD, but nearly all the Torah is missing. Just time, just worn away. We also have the Cairo Codex from 895 AD, which has the prophetic books, but not the writings or the Torah. So these are our oldest, a long time after the stuff was written. The Qumran scrolls gave us manuscripts that are over 1,000 years older than the Leningrad or Aleppo Codex. And it's interesting to note that where there's more than one manuscript of a text, parts of Isaiah might be found in K4 and some are found in K5, and they happen to cover the same material. There are variations in the Hebrew, this one and this one. They're quite different. They're slightly different, let's say. Even though they're going right back to the first century BC. The Qumran scrolls predate the work of rabbis in the closing decades of the first century AD to establish an official standard text. It's when Jerusalem was destroyed, when Christianity had bled, a lot of Jews had joined the Christian community, that those who stayed Jews got together at a place called Jumnia on the east coast of the Mediterranean, a little town there. They got together there, the rabbis, and they fixed their codex. These are our texts, this is the script, and they finalized it. Qumran is prior to that, so you can have a bit of variation. After this, no, there's no variation because they've standardized the text. There's an example of a bit of the Qumran scroll, just a copy of it for you to look at. Bits missing, bits missed, whatever, and not all. And sometimes they've got tiniest little snippets. So thank God again, you've got people who are spending their whole life trying to discern and correct and look at and work out what the Qumran scrolls are saying, because they're not just pure, continuous scrolls. The rabbis at Jumnia in the closing decades of the first century, faced with the emergence of Christianity and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Roman army, were determined to establish a standard Hebrew text. This doesn't guarantee that what they produced represents an original text, or that it's necessarily more inspired than other extant versions. They've got to make choices. In 1952, biblical manuscripts from the period of the Second Uprising, which was in 132 to 135 AD, they were discovered in a cave at Wadi Murbaat, 18 kilometres south of Qumran. These are 40 years after the standardising of the text, and these texts that they found in there witness to the success of the work begun by the rabbis of Jumnia. There's much less variation in them. So clearly there has been a standardising of the text. Now, in spite of the immense care taken in copying the sacred text, and that's what the Qumran scrolls showed, at 1100 years prior to the Leningrad Codex, you've got, for the largest part, identical texts, slight variations, yeah, but basically, so clearly, immense care was put into the 1100 years of copying since the Qumran scrolls, and 200 years earlier than that, prior to Qumran. Ancient translations play an important role in our attempt to establish the true Hebrew text, which is what we want to get if we can. The Greek Septuagint from the 2nd century BC is especially significant. Not infrequently, there are differences between the Greek Septuagint, Jewish translation, and the Hebrew text developed by the Masoretes, scholars whose aim was to oversee the accuracy of copies of the Hebrew text, and they can differ. Each variant, I used to assume before I did my study that of course the Hebrew would be more authentic than the Greek. You'd expect that because the Greek is a translation. But not in, I learned that you can't assume that, not infrequently the Greek translation comes from a more authentic Hebrew text than the one we've got. You can imagine that happening. One that's closer, and you look at it. So you've got to just not be, you've got to watch carefully. Each particular bit has to be looked at, examined in its own right. And sometimes the Septuagint is clearly representing a more ancient and more authentic Hebrew text than the standard Hebrew that was fixed at Jamnia. And all I've said there is that while refinements are still going on, you can be quite happy when you open your Bible in English, the standard ordinary ones, that it's been well translated and that you are in touch with a good official text, getting as close as we can to the original text of the Hebrew Bible. Every now and then, discoveries will be made that help us tweak a bit. There are many words, for example, in the Hebrew. Hebrew doesn't have a vast vocabulary. It's a pretty small group of people up in the highlands of what we now call Palestine. It's a fairly small language. Aramaic is much bigger, from Syria. And then that became the language, the standard, the lingua franca, could we call it, of the Persian Empire. So it's a small language. And I'm not sure what I was going to say about that fact that it's a small language now. Skipped my mind. Sometimes there are many words in it that only occur once. It might be about a tree. And you're not sure whether it's talking about a tree or a flower or an animal, because it only occurs once, and any of those would fit the context. What's happened in the last 100 years, let's put it more vaguely, we've discovered other libraries. And not infrequently from the libraries of the northern part of Syria or from somewhere in the Semitic world, we find a word that's like this word, and in the context it's clearly an animal, a kind of little, I'll say rabbit, but that's not a very good word, but that kind of an animal. So we get clarified, things like that happening all the time. So, first part of science is we've got to establish the text, and the people are doing that, great. Secondly, there are sciences that are concerned with establishing the meaning of the text. Okay, we've got the text, what does it mean? So, we've got to look at the meaning of words, and we've got to look at the meaning of grammatical constructions, idioms in the language. How are they used? Scholars are constantly refining our understanding of the nuances of different words and of different grammatical constructions in the ancient Hebrew. A couple of days ago I mentioned one, zahar, which is nearly always translated warn. I think it should be translated enlighten. Not quite the same. In fact, enlighten is a much richer term. And I could argue to that, there's no point of doing it here. But that's a refinement that's come in the translation of a particular word. Well, that Hebrew words are found in the Old Testament only once, I mentioned that. It's difficult, without comparison, to determine the exact meaning. Now, the discovery here, some of the library of Ashurbanipal of Nineveh, discovered in 1853, the discoveries at Ugarit, in what is now Syria, north of Lebanon, in the 1920s, and other discoveries have greatly enlarged our understanding of ancient Semitic languages. Literary criticism. Literature has never consisted in simply adding words to words or sentences to sentences. Its aim is to communicate, and to do this successfully, it takes a certain shape. The role of literary criticism is, and quoting again from that document from the Pontifical Biblical Commission, the role of literary criticism is to determine the beginning and end of textual units, large and small, and to establish the internal coherence of the text. Little sayings, hymns, whatever. So the first part of all this, and you've heard of this often, is called genre criticism. You better know what the genre is you're dealing with. Today, for example, if it's a newspaper article, fine. You can get a bit of an idea, if you bother reading them, of what it might mean as a newspaper article. If it's a play, you're going to look at it differently. If it's a description, if it's a cookery book and you want to follow it, you better take it pretty seriously, because the amounts have been put in very carefully. So you're going to read differently than you would a drama from Shakespeare or a poem from Keats. So the literary genre is very important. To interpret the text accurately, it's necessary to know what kind of literary form we're dealing with. The reader, this is Alonzo Schurkel, who, beautiful poetic Jesuit, when I did my studies, he was in Rome. Sadly, I kept missing him. I wanted to do the Psalms with him, and he wasn't doing them while I was studying in Rome, doing my course. However, he did write, I found it years later, a two-volume work. He wrote it in Spanish, but thank God they translated it into Italian, which I can kind of handle. And so I worked my own psalm. I used him a lot because he really felt the language. But I did go to two lectures that he gave. One was on the Song of Songs, and one the other, I can't remember. And I was like sitting there listening to a poet. He knew the stuff so beautifully, but he also could say it in Hebrew in a way that you felt the music of the Song of Songs. Only a little bit of it he did, but I thought, wow, I'd love to get some more from him. He's in heaven now, dear man, so I'll have to wait in the hope that I get somewhere near him in that place. So he wrote anyhow, the reader who's ignorant of these forms, genres, is the one who's likely to deform the author's work, just as would a musician who mistook the key or mode of the composer. That's a good image, isn't it? It's written in E minor, and I'm playing the damn thing in D major. Well, I think it's not going to sound like very good music. You've got to get the key right, or obvious, but he just says it so well. But we did that for a long time, and we would still be doing it if we're not careful. We took a lot of things as fact. The flood was a fact. And all we needed to do was look at it. But anyhow, that's what we tended to do, because we knew it was true. We knew there was truth in it. We knew that people respected it. We knew that somehow there was an inspiration breathing in the text. So we didn't want to just cast it aside because it didn't fit modern scientific history. But we tended to think, well, we didn't know what to do. We didn't know how to handle it in the light of history and criticism. And then we've got to realise it's poetry, it's stories. And once we do that, we can relax back and enjoy it. The creation account, which opens Genesis, is a liturgical hymn. You've got to put it to music, for God's sake. You've got to have trumpets blasting an angel singing, if you can find one. We've got to, it's not an attempt to give an accurate chronological account. That wasn't what it's saying. They had no way of doing that. But in the poetry and in the music and in the hymn, that chapter one of the book of Genesis says some absolutely stunningly beautiful things about creation, man, woman, etc. And they're there to be gleaned by a poetically appreciative person, not locked in as contrast to science. Now I'm going to spend a bit of time on this because there's nothing more important to say about the genre than to say this. The key genre of the Old Testament is story. Now that's not going to surprise anyone who's lived in Aboriginal missions or who's been anywhere where people are alive and are handing on a long old tradition, and they mightn't even write but their language, but they live it. And story is the way you communicate. There are many ways of communicating truth. The writing of history is one way, of course. It involves the careful establishment of what actually happened, as well as a careful attempt to express something of the significance of what happened. A historian doesn't just put fact after fact after fact after fact, or you scrap it. They've got to have perspective and meaning and attempt to put things in some kind of way to help you see what the facts are really saying at a deeper level. Of course they're doing that. But there are limits to history's capacity to express truth. The kinds of answers we give are dependent on the questions that we're asking and the perspective from which we approach the past. Truth can also be communicated through other forms of art which aim to awaken the imagination as distinct from appealing to the logic of discursive reasoning. And through the imagination, open up insight. Brackets. You could go to a play on apartheid, a 2-hour play, and you could come out of it, if it's well done, with much more insight into what apartheid felt like from both angles than you would if you read a 7-volume work by a historian full of footnotes on apartheid, because it's just massive, whereas an artist might be able to get your imagination and you think, ah! Insight kind of might, well, you know what I'm saying, might hit you through the story, through the drama, through the music, through the silence, through the backdrop. A film can tell you so much that we need 10-volume works with footnotes, and they do an important role, obviously, but we need artists, we need lovers, we need kind of people who wrote the Bible. A video can tell us something of what actually was going on. So can a painted portrait or a film. These take us inside the facts of what is really going on. A well-told story can have the same effect. Prior to the Greek period, that's late 4th century BC, writers in the ancient Near East generally expressed their insights not in history, but in epic, saga, song, and story. In every culture. The Greeks started to develop, only started, a more scientific approach to factual recording. Other writings from the ancient world chose the elevated, poetic, and sophisticated style of epic literature, a style typical of an aristocratic and ruling class. That would be the style of story that you find in the Greek world and in the Egyptian world, others as well, but they're ones we're more likely to be familiar with. And it's very from top-down stuff. Not so Israel. In the Bible, we find a more popular style. Open to everyone, the style of storytelling. This style links immediately with experience and provides a simple and effective way of sharing experience and so sharing truth. You might be thinking for the moment of those early chapters of Genesis, and clearly it applies there, but it actually applies to the whole of the Old Testament. We know nothing about David. We know he existed from a little ostraca from Dan, we found. So it talked about the Davidic dynasty. So David certainly existed. That's the limit of our historical knowledge of David. And yet you find in the book of Kings a whole lot of stuff about David. So what is it? Is it remembered events? Remembered 400 years after David? Maybe. Could be. Some of it might be. Or is it someone talking to the king now and dramatically focusing on David? He's on stage. And what God's saying to him, and he's saying to God, and what he's doing, nobody knows what he's doing because the records aren't there. What we watch him doing is all telling the king now how to be a king, and us how to obey and not obey, and what really matters and what God wants of us. That's what it's about. It's engaging the current readers. That's its purpose. And it's engaging them by, maybe we'd call it drama, dramatically presenting their long-ago founder of Judah. This marvellous, must have been a marvellous character, this Mujahideen from the Pakistan border. And he was a bully and a whatever he was. It's all about that. That's the picture, but it's talking to us. This brings us to a key insight that we must have as we approach this inspired literature. It's that for the most part, the Older Testament offers us truth as truth is expressed in a story. Get to the meaning of the story and you get to what was inspired. The stories draw on facts. They draw on some facts in here, but only rarely do we find in them what we'd call history. By the way, the New Testament is written in this same storytelling world. So you've got to read it with a bit of care. The parables of Jesus, they're stories. Well, you know that. That's kind of obvious. We don't have to say, oh, a Samaritan. I wonder what a Samaritan was doing in that. Or we don't have to say, oh yeah, I knew that man and he had two sons. Yeah. It's not about a person who had two sons. It's a story about that. The power of Jesus is right in his long tradition in telling stories to communicate profound truths and very effectively. The Gospels record what Jesus said and did, but they also offer an interpretive commentary. They don't just give us the facts. They're interpreting it by putting this before that and this next to that and leaving that out and bringing this in and putting, John puts it, the emptying of the temple right at the beginning, chapter 2. The others, and presumably this is much more accurate, they put it right at the end. And it's the reason why the final reason, the nail in the coffin, that got them to kill Jesus on that Passover. Because he'd disturbed the temple and clearly they had to get rid of him. Well, why does John put it in too? Well, you've got to study John to find that out. But he does put it in too, for his reasons. He puts it straight after the beautiful scene, which is a story, of the Cana and the marriage feast. John the Beloved sees that, I'm telling you about this now, but it's relevant to the way we should be reading the Old Testament. He sees that people are good at doing the religious thing. They're good at obeying, they're good at everything, because everybody had to in their culture. One does it, they all do it. But they're not good at knowing that God is love. That's what they're not getting. So right at the beginning, chapter 2, verse 1, John, no doubt Jesus did go to wedding feasts and other He's always seemed to be having a meal with somebody. So we're not denying that he went to a wedding feast, maybe even at Cana. But what John wants us to see is the love of the bridegroom. He wants to see Jesus as the bridegroom, God as the bridegroom of our soul. And so he presents this beautiful scene of water, the human stuff inside us, moved, changed into wine, a symbol of the Spirit, of course, in the Old Testament, the fruit, the blood of the vine. So this is the wine of the Spirit. That's what he's talking about. And when he puts that scene in, the very next scene is the emptying of the temple. So he's asking his readers to choose. The temple has been emptied. If you want to be a Christian, you've got to move into a different place, a different category, a different community, a different vision of the world, a different way of looking at God, and you've got to choose. That's all in chapter 2. Read John carefully in chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's 10 more chapters is all about choosing. Do you want this? Or do you want that? Do you actually want the temple? Do you want to stay with the temple? Fine, if you want to. Why would you want to? When you've got a love feast that's possible for you. And the love feast then in chapter 13 is the Last Supper, the Eucharist and the rest of it. I've gone on too long about that. But what I'm trying to say is in these New Testament texts, the author is from a position that's beautiful, faithful, and because the gospel was kept, we know it's valuable. Other gospels were doing that too, but they weren't kept. They weren't worth it. They weren't worth copying, for God's sake. No one was interested. When the people assembled on the Sabbath, they said, oh, read out John again, would you? But nobody said, read out the gospel of Judas again. Nobody did, so they didn't copy it. Died, except in the desert, when their copies were buried and survived. We've got, it's called canonicity, we've got beautiful writings that the beautiful community have kept, preserved, cherished and passed on. But in the middle of them all, Luke has a different way of looking at things than Matthew, and Matthew than Mark, and Mark from Peter, and John, and James. Different, they're all consistent, but the documents are not just factual 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those responsible for the book of Genesis, with its presentation of an Israelite perspective on ancient Semitic myths, and that's what we know it is now, about the primeval beginnings of the universe, those responsible for the presentation of the essence of Yahwism in the stories concerning Moses, and those responsible for the prophetic interpretation of the history of the Israelite tribes and kingdoms of Israel and Judah. They were interested in history in the sense that they were interested in real people and real people's lives. But their aim was to connect their contemporaries with the precious religious insights that had come down to them from their ancestors. And they had no trouble in using folklore, legend and whatever else they could lay their hands on to help them achieve this aim of connecting with their contemporaries and inviting them into faith in the God of Moses. Like all the writings of the ancient Near East, they drew on oral tradition, in which ongoing interest wields more power than concern for historical evidence. They drew on written sources too, where these were available. They wrote to engage the imagination and encourage fidelity to tradition. So they relied heavily on story to communicate insight into the truth. Most of the texts of the Old Testament don't provide the kind of evidence needed to establish a secure history. What they do, however, is offer powerful stories which carry a rich variety of attempts to come to terms with profound human experiences in the light of faith in Yahweh. In these times of insecurity that continue to spawn fundamentalism, insecurity it is, and we want something to be secure on, so rather than trust our brother and sister and a faulty community which has sinners in it as well as saints, thank God, that's drawing sinners to become saints. But it's a messy group because I'm in it and you're in it and it's human. And it wants to be all embracing the way Jesus was. So thank God there's room for everyone in it. Hopefully there's a conversion process happening because at the heart of it is Jesus. But people are free and people, I may not choose yet to be converted, but I can still come in and belong, still part of the family, thank God. No one's going to push me out. Jesus isn't and the church shouldn't. So that's where our security comes from, being human, belonging, part of this messy but a marvellous history of the human race. It doesn't come from a book. It doesn't come from something we can control and define and lock meaning in. Robert Alter, to conclude this point on story, in a book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, he's a Jewish writer, and the concluding paragraph of his book is really beautiful, very simple and lovely. The Hebrew writers manifestly took delight in the artful liming, and because I didn't know what that meant, I'm helping you by putting it in brackets in case you don't. It's got to do with depicting, really, and a few other things. But the Hebrew writers manifestly took delight in the artful depicting of lifelike characters. Joab is a lifelike character. Samson is a lifelike character. David is. And they all are. Samuel is. On stage, they impress us. And so they created an unexhausted source of delight for 100 generation of readers. But that pleasure of imaginative play is deeply interfused with a sense of great spiritual urgency. The biblical writers fashioned their personages with a complicated, sometimes alluring, often fiercely insistent individuality. Because it is in the stubbornness of human individuality that each man and woman encounters God or ignores God, responds to or resists God. Subsequent religious tradition, says this Jewish author, subsequent religious tradition has by and large encouraged us to take the Bible seriously rather than enjoy it. But the paradoxical truth of the matter may well be that by learning to enjoy the biblical stories more fully as stories, we shall also come to see more clearly what they mean to tell us about God, about man, and the perilously momentous realm of history. Joe, that's good. You can find it on my website if you think you've lost it, and that's in my book as well, if you want to go back over it. The faith of Israel is a historical faith, essentially related to ways in which God has been experienced in their history. But there are more ways, and often more effective ways, of expressing truth than by accurate statements of historical fact. The authors were real human beings whose aim was to alter their contemporaries, to alert their contemporaries to the meaning of their history for their current circumstances. Always have that in mind. When something's written, it's written for people to read now. That's the focus. Not to establish an accurate historical record. Their explicit focus was not on accurate historical detail, but on the way they understood God to have acted in their past and to be acting now in their present. And the stories, like a mirror, could capture that for us. History, for those responsible for the writings of the Old Testament, was a way of understanding their destiny in the world as a people special to Yahweh. To be an Israelite is to share in the faith of a people who believe that God liberates from slavery and that the way to receive the special blessings promised them by God is to listen to Yahweh and to do his will. The biblical writers are not seeking to give their readers historically accurate information about their past. They are interested in forming the consciousness of the nation by keeping before them the stories that remind them of who they are and what they're called to be. If we are wondering how much of these stories is an accurate record of events and how much is an imaginative statement intended to highlight the presence and action of Yahweh in the lives of the ancient Israelites and in the lives of those to whom the writing was intended, it's worth recalling, make this point now, that, for example, the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings, and I've done this already, but highlight it here, they are included in the Hebrew Bible as books of prophecy, not history. They don't claim to be history. They're prophecy. Their primary focus is on Yahweh. Not on Moses, not on Samuel, not on the kings who led Israel and Judah in the years prior to the Babylonian exile. They're always hoping that we'll watch the play and think, ah, that's who God was then, that's who God is now. Let's be faithful to this beautiful God. The truth that is the primary object of their assertion is the truth of Yahweh's choice of us as his people and Yahweh's fidelity to his commitment to us, the chosen people. That's how they saw. To be an Israelite is to share in the faith of a people who believe that God liberates from slavery and that the way to receive the special blessings promised by God is to listen to Yahweh and do Yahweh's will. Those stories about Moses, Samuel and David would have been told and retold over the generations, of course. It was all far too long ago for the authors of the stories to attempt to establish the historical facts. Nor was that their interest. Their interest was in their contemporaries, and they tell the story of their distant ancestors in such a way as to shed light on the situations the people were facing at the time of writing. And we're going to come to that further down the track. So the question to be asked as we read these stories is not, can we be confident that we're reading historically accurate accounts of past events? That's not the question. The question is God really the way God is presented here in this scene? Are we to respond to God in the way that this account states? If I'm the king and I've done dreadful things, am I being told to respond the way David did when he wept and when he asked for mercy, admitted his sin, broke down, and then remained faithful? Is that what I'm being called? Yes, that's what it's about. In light of the fact that so many good people are responsible for the writing and that the stories have been reflected on, treasured, preserved and handed on by faithful people for centuries, we should surely trust that allowing for the necessary imperfections of people and language, which we've talked about a lot, the inspired insights will guide us well. And then I've got to add, how beautiful it is that we have Jesus to guide us in discerning which stories do get to the heart and which stories represent the blind spots and the blinkered view of people in Judah when that was written. It was said to of old, but I say to you. The authors wanted their contemporaries to learn the lessons of the past and to be faithful to the faith of their ancestors. It's this faith that is expressed powerfully, memorably, and truly in the stories presented in the Older Testament. Now there's a few other, the genre we're reading, on the whole, when you're reading the Old Testament, start from the assumption that it's a story, and you'll go fine. It'll work really well for you. Every now and then there may happen to be historical bits in it, and so that's good, interesting, but it's secondary. Another element of study that goes into all this. We're drawn into a narrative world. Because much of the text has its origin in storytelling, we need to grasp the styles of storytelling in ancient Near East. Not the same as the Aboriginal ways or the Irish great storytellers or today. They'll have their own ways of telling stories. Some scholars spend their time working out that, noticing that, alerting us to that. We need also to observe the effect such stories still have upon a community of listeners. Here's a statement from the Pontifical Biblical Commission. Narrative analysis insists that the text functions not only as a window giving access to one or other period, not only to the situation which the story relates, but also to that of the community for whom the story is told, but also it acts as a mirror in the sense that it projects a certain image, a narrative world, which exercises an influence upon readers' perceptions in such a way as to bring them to adopt certain values rather than others. Because much of the text has its origin in... What is written in the book of Genesis, says Pope John Paul II, what is written in the book of Genesis expressed in the form of a symbolic narrative. So what I'm telling you now, you know this, but it's all authentic Catholic and not only Catholic, biblical teaching. Here's our Pope telling us that Genesis is a symbolic narrative, not a history. The stories in Genesis chapter 1 to 11 are telling us how we got to be the way we are as God's faith in God's faithful love. We're created in God's image, but we fail to rely on God. We're created to live in the paradise of intimacy with God. Though we long for this, we feel like outsiders. We're not in paradise. We're not in the garden. But God somehow continues to care for us. All that's said in those texts. John, rushing a bit here, it talks about the problem of farmers and shepherds over water in their world. So the farmer, Abel, and the shepherd, I've got that wrong, haven't I? Anyhow, whatever my brain's doing, one of them represents the farmer and one represents the shepherd. And I think it's Cain representing it. Cain, by the way, in Hebrew means Smith. So it's as common a name in Hebrew as Smith is in English. So if your name's Smith, you're not ending up too well in this story. So you've got Smith, the farmer, the city person, and then you've got the people with their sheep and coming in, and they're getting into our wells and trampling on our... So there's fight going on. So it's in the fight between Cain and Abel. But God still protects Cain, as you know. Violence, that's the key sin. By the way, Hamas, you've heard of Hamas. Hebrew means violence. So Hamas is the key sin of the book of Genesis. And what violence does, it brings the whole of creation, humankind, to the very verge of the destruction of the world. So the processes, the heavens, everything's we nearly go right back to chaos. It's a reversal. The flood, as you know, is not a rain. The flood is when the firmament, this is their way of understanding it, the sky is solid and there are little holes in it, and you can see light through them if you look carefully at night, and that's just seeing into heaven. But through those holes, rain comes too, because there's water everywhere. And that's all. But the firmament collapses. So the waters up there and the waters here join. That's the flood. That's how they see it. And then this temple, Israel, the temple of Judah, rising above it. The Torah, the prophets, the writings, out of all light coming and showing us how not to get caught in the chaos that surrounds us. Rhetorical criticism is a school of study, and if you're familiar with it, but rhetoric has its own inner laws. When Jesus, I'll give you an example from Luke, Jesus talks about new wine in old skins, you know, but the last word in Luke's one is old wine is best. Well, probably all you people who know about wine would probably agree. And that's, now, is Jesus saying old wine is best? No, it's rhetorical. He's saying this is what everybody's thinking. His point is it's not best. There's new wine coming now, a new revelation, and you'll need new skins. That was the trouble, by the way, with Vatican II. We turned the altar around, and the priest who'd always stood with his back to the people saying, "The Lord be with you," and it didn't matter whether how happy he was. Suddenly the poor man of my age, you know, having done it the other way for years and years, was supposed to turn around, and here's all these people looking at him, and he's not used to it, he might even be a bit shy. So he says, "The Lord be with you." Sounds very attractive, doesn't it? Don't blame the poor bloke, but no one helped him and no one trained him and he didn't know what to do. So we brought the new wine of the Vatican II in, but the church was the old container. Didn't fit. So rhetorical criticism is recognizing that a lot of the Bible is meant not to be read, because most people couldn't read. It's meant to be heard. Therefore, it's meant to be proclaimed. Therefore, it has its own rules in the way it's constructed. Similarly, if I could not get too distracted, the Jerusalem Bible, which we're still using in the church, thanks be to God, it's the only attempt anyone's ever made to write a text that can be proclaimed. All the rest, they're good. You can sit under an apple tree and read them and they're accurate and all, that's very lovely. But the Jerusalem Bible was done by experts from the Greek and the Hebrew, of course, but then they got scholars. They got Tolkien to come in and do one of them. And he actually set Macaulay, James Macaulay, Speight, one of the leading Catholic Shakespearean actors, and there was a whole list of them in the front. They got them to actually come and create the text accurately, but in a way that was rhetorical. So we can still hear it, and it does kind of land. And then these brilliant people who've already changed the liturgy and improved it and made it more formal and unintelligible, that they were going to have a go at the Bible too. Anyhow, I'll get too carried away with all that. But just for the moment, thank God, they were going to use this one and then that one and then that one, other translations. The latest I heard is they're going to stick with the Jerusalem Bible and tweak it. And I thought, you little beauty. It needs tweaking. But either get artists to create the next version for us or tweak the Jerusalem Bible. But don't just put it aside and muck up the whole thing so that you hear the text from the pulpit, but it doesn't hit you. It doesn't engage you. You just, your mind picks up the thing. The language has to be rhetorical. Much of the Old Testament is a written record of words spoken in the liturgy, uttered by a prophet. It was for the most part written to be spoken by a preacher and heard by the assembly. Its aim was not simply to communicate meaning, but to persuade and inculcate religious values. This affected the style, and grasping ancient techniques of persuasive language can help us recognize irony, humor, exaggeration in the text. Jesus' parables are full of exaggeration. They're kind of a bit bizarre, they're wonderful, but they're the seed that was planted, landed on them. You know, every farmer thinks, oh God, what a boring story. Till the last bit when he says, the seed that fell in good soil produced a hundredfold. My God, all their ears came up. Where do you get this seed? Now he's got them asking questions, he can start to connect. Before that, they weren't asking any questions. Now they're very interested. And he's talking, of course, about the revelation of God that's coming through his word. But it's the shock of the 100%, hundredfold, that actually gets people alerted. Well, every parable has got something like that in it to hit us, shock us. A Samaritan helping a Jew. Rhetorical criticism, says the Biblical Commission, aims to penetrate to the very core of the language of revelation precisely as persuasive religious discourse, and to measure the impact of such discourse in the social context of the communication thus begun. So thank God we've got people who are aware of all this, looking at the Bible, helping translate it, helping to understand what this text would mean if it was heard rather than just read. I've got examples there, but there's too many and you don't have any time. There are disciplines also in the scientific endeavour which are seeking to discover, this is a very difficult area and often not very persuasive. We've got the text in front of us, great. But they're trying to see, are there any hints in this as to where that bit came from? What was the prehistory, even pre-written history, of the text that we've got in front of us? Very subtle, very difficult, and not often very successful, but people are trying to do that. Tradition criticism, to conclude, yes. This attempts to supplement source criticism, which is looking for the sources of the written text as we have it, by constructing the genesis of the text from its origins, and its origins may have been a song, the Song of Deborah, the crossing of the Red Sea. It may be a song and it's been brought in here. It may be a joke. It may be something that was said in the tavern as a comical bit of piece, and now we're finding it in the Book of Numbers, chapter whatever. So they want to see if they can look at the way the text has developed from its origins, wherever, to its final transmitted form, uncovering the prehistory, oral and written, of each literary unit. And I don't really want to say much more about that. Here is an example that's really such an obvious example when you look at it. It might just take... Well, I suppose I'm asking you to forgive me. It might take a bit of time. This is a beautiful psalm that you love and often say. And the way I've put it out for you there is to try to help you see it's wonderfully constructed. It starts... Be gracious to me, O God, according to your kindness. According to the tender compassion, blot out my transgressions. Go to the very bottom. Hide your face from my sin. Oh dear. Hide your face from my sins. Blot out all my guilt. See the blot out underlined. It's in the first part and it's in that part. If you look through the rest of them, you'll also find words. Wash me thoroughly from my guilt. Down below. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you've crushed rejoice. Up the top. Purify me from my sins. down below. Am I doing this too fast, or can you follow my logic? Like a mirror image, it's mirroring. Down below, purge me from with hyssop and I shall be purified. Up the top, for I know my transgressions, my sin is ever before me. Down below, you desire truth in my innermost being, therefore in my hidden depths make me know wisdom. Know. Up the top, against you, you alone have I sinned, and what is evil in your sight I have done. Down below, indeed I was born in guilt, in sin, when my mother conceived me. And then the key point in the middle of that mirror, so that you are acknowledged as just in your sentence and blameless when you pass judgment. That's where we're supposed to focus in this whole prayer. That's only the first part of the psalm. Second part, similarly balanced, mirrored, finely constructed. Up the top, create in me a purified heart, O God. Right at the bottom, a broken and crushed heart, O God, you will not despise. Up the top, put a new and right spirit within me. Down below, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken, contrite, broken spirit. Up the top, do not cast me away from your presence. Down below, if I were to give a burnt offering, you would not be pleased. Up the top, restore to me the joy of your salvation and sustain in me a generous spirit. Down below, deliver me from bloodshed, O God of my salvation, and my tongue will sing aloud of your justice. O Lord, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise. And the central point of the mirror, then I will teach transgressors your ways and sinners will return to you. Why I've done that terribly hurriedly, and there's a lot more in it than I can do now, you're dealing with clearly a complete poem, highly constructed, beautifully organised, the psalm. But look what the last verse says. Do good in Zion, to Zion in your good pleasure, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Then you'll delight in right sacrifices, in burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then bulls will be offered on your altar. I don't need to persuade you. Nothing wrong with that. It's part of the inspired text, but it's clearly a later addition. If that was intended in the first one, it would be part of the very beautiful poetic poems. It's put in later in a different situation by people who are singing this in the temple, but now the walls have been destroyed of the city. And so, just from a literary point of view, you can tell this has been added on. Nothing wrong with it, but that's what you know has happened. And when you go through any of the psalms, you can often see bits that have been added in, come from a later perspective. Finally, canonical criticism. This is the key one, and more scholars are realising with all these, and I've jumped a few there as you saw, all these different scholarly expertise coming in from different angles. Here we come to the key thing. What really finally matters is the text that we've got in front of us, the canonical text. Our main interest is with the text in the final form in which we now have it. For this is the text that the community has accepted for 2,000 years. And they've accepted it as inspired. Thank God for all this help. But let's take the text as it stands. This is the text which for centuries now has been a source of contemplation for believers. Enriched by the information gleaned from the various disciplines that we've noted, the exegete must go back to the actual written text for the richer and deeper synthesis of its meaning as we now have it. A study of the function of the canon in the ongoing community of faith is also informative. Here's the Pontifical Biblical Commission. The Church reads the Old Testament in the light, this is what Christians bring to bear, of the Paschal mystery, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, who brings a radical newness and with sovereign authority gives a meaning to the scriptures that's decisive and definitive. This new determination of meaning has become an integral element of Christian faith. The canonical approach, reading again from the 1993 Declaration of the Commission, the canonical approach aims to carry out the theological task of interpretation more successfully by beginning from within an explicit framework of faith, the Bible as a whole. To achieve this, it interprets each biblical text in the light of the canon of scriptures. That is to say, of the Bible as received as the norm of faith by a community of believers. The canonical approach rightly reacts against placing an exaggerated value upon what is supposed to be the original and early, as if this was more authentic. Inspired scripture is precisely scripture in that it has been recognized by the Church as the rule of faith. Hence the significance in this light of both the final form in which each of the books of the Bible appears and the complete whole. So every text is interpreted by every other text. Each individual book only becomes biblical in the light of the canon as a whole. It's the believing community that provides a truly adequate context for interpreting canonical texts. In this context, faith and the Holy Spirit enrich exegesis. Church authority, exercised as a service of the community, must see to it that this interpretation remains faithful to the great tradition which has produced the text. It's important, therefore, to read the text as part of the whole Bible. It's important to read it within the believing community within which it emerged and was preserved. It's important to read it in the Spirit, in a prayerful text. It is a prayerful text. Finally, and I conclude now and then I'll give you a bit of music. Finally, it's important to read it in the light of the revelation made in Jesus Christ, to read it with the mind and heart of Jesus. Jesus' disciples believe that he brought the part revelation of the Old Testament to its fulfillment, revealing in fuller light what was inspired in it and correcting what is obscure and imperfect. I'm exhausted, I presume you are too. But anyway, I didn't want to spend more than one period on it. Massive amount of studies kind of going on as we sit here, and thank God for it. And it's all helping us know how to hear this wonderful material in prayer, not on our own, but as part of a living faith community that's got history with it and is current us. So the hymn I want to finish off is Open My Eyes.